Home is a feeling of familiarity. Home is a feeling of comfort. And so we really need to apply those principles to enabling the design. And the other component of that from a regulatory standpoint is that our policies and our funding models and our procurement even is still very siloed.
Welcome to Coming of Age, a podcast that is changing the conversation on aging. I'm your host, Donna Duncan, CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association. This season, season four of Coming of Age, we welcome an exciting roster of guests from around the world, thought leaders who are at the forefront of transforming seniors' living and care and are shaping the future for all of us as we age. Welcome back to a new episode of Coming of Age. In this episode, we turn our attention to New Brunswick, Canada, a province where innovative solutions for seniors' care are setting an example for the rest of Canada, but also for the world. Throughout the season, we've been asking, how do we design care models that meet the needs of diverse communities? Today, let's explore how a province navigating the challenges of caring for older adults in rural settings has introduced forward-thinking approaches to connection, housing, and care. Our guest today is Aimée Foreman, a leader in aged care and CEO of Silvermark. In New Brunswick, Aimée is a purpose-driven entrepreneur and advocate whose work focuses on redefining seniors' care. Drawing from personal experience, Aimée's efforts are a testament to her dedication to addressing the challenges faced by aging populations and caregivers. She is the founding chair of Caregivers New Brunswick, the sixth provincial organization dedicated to supporting family and friend caregivers. In our conversation, Aimée shares how New Brunswick is balancing the immediate needs of seniors with longer-term planning, all while fostering community-driven models of care that prioritize connection, housing, and care. Her bold vision challenges us to rethink how we define seniors' care. Let's dive in. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Staffstat. Welcome back, listeners. It is such a privilege for me today to be joined by Aimée Foreman, Aging Care Advisor and CEO of Silvermark in New Brunswick. It really is great to have representation from the East Coast of Canada to bring some insights and share thought. But I think Aimée is such a leader and such a dynamic speaker. I know all of you are really going to enjoy today's discussion. So with that, welcome, Aimée. So pleased that you're here.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really inspired by you and the work that you're leading, not only within New Brunswick, but also across Canada and the conversations that you're having. You're really bringing a different lens to how we talk about aged care, seniors living. And so I'm wondering if perhaps you could start it off just by sharing your vision of what communities of care should look like. And we're always talking about communities of care, campuses of care. So our listeners have heard a lot of those terms, but you're bringing some new definitions to this.
Yeah, thank you for that, Donna. And I'll just share maybe to set our conversation on what my sort of principal beliefs are in terms of communities of care. And I really think it's threefold. I think if we approach both our built environments, also programming and policy, by solving for connection first, then solving for housing, then solving for care, we will set ourselves up to really evolve the sector in much the way that we all talk about aspirationally. And so whenever I'm working with folks, whether it's for profit, nonprofit, public sector, we're really trying to turn the tables on how we make decisions and make those decisions from a value-based perspective. And so that's why sort of the shorthand of that I like to use is connection first, housing second, care third.
And why do you put connection first?
We all know that the greatest plague to aging well is loneliness. Or per Dr. Bill Thomas, who I had the benefit of some mentorship when I came into the sector early, it's loneliness, boredom, lack of purpose, if you will. There's been a lot of conversation about loneliness and isolation, particularly since the pandemic. And so those of us who have been in the sector have always known that's a hindrance to aging well. I think with COVID and everybody having experienced isolation in a different way, it's better understood now. Even from a political will perspective or from a government perspective, there's a deeper understanding of what the impact of loneliness has on us. There's also rising conversations about social determinants of health and social prescribing. So in all of that vein, I like to look at aging from a social perspective and not just from a health perspective, because aging in itself is not an illness. We have over-medicalized, over-institutionalized our sector, and we're mostly all working to change that. But to change that means we have to put a very different lens on the decisions that we're making.
Well, and to that point, when you and I were speaking earlier, we were talking about some of the parallels with other parts of the system. And I can't help but wonder if we're not actually doing our seniors a disfavor, including coming out of the pandemic, where a lot of those in the media and on social media would say that we have to lock in, lock down, and then super protect our seniors. I spent decades as a mental health advocate and have done a lot of work in both adult and children's mental health. And I think of the work that I was involved in with the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto and its redevelopment, where the whole theory behind it was to bring the community in and bring our clients and residents and our services out to create more of a sense of community and neighborhood and to break out of that 17th, 18th century paradigm where we're going to take individuals who have a mental illness and we're going to hide them behind walls. And so deliberately segregating individuals, protecting them within the walls, but yet not letting others come and see. And it really did, I believe, foster greater stigma, greater lack of understanding or awareness of who individuals are. It dehumanized individuals living with mental illness. And I do worry that some of the reaction to coming out of the pandemic, where we have to have our residents locked in, we can't have visitors in, you have to have masking all the time, you can't have any kind of freedom. And I'm really curious, because I know you're thinking differently about what a neighborhood is and what community is, and have looked at different models that have and could be evolving to deal with normalizing aging with the sense of community instead of us all feeling that we just have to restrict the freedom of our residents.
Certainly appreciate those reflections. And I'll just stay on connection a little bit longer and then I'll move to housing because I think it's an important piece of the puzzle. So in terms of connection and your reference to safety, and so our whole sector has been structured around safety. It's a checklist sector. It's highly regulated. And ask friends and family or even practitioners, you know, they'll probably say they want to keep older adults safe. But if you ask older adults themselves, none of them will give you that answer. So when we went in lockdown, when we made all of that protocol in place, and I understand why we did, although we certainly can learn from other jurisdictions and individual homes and leadership that chose to do it differently, I very much don't think we ever stopped and asked what was best for the residents' well-being, right? We were avoiding risk. And people want to live with risk. And when you ask older adults or what's most important to them, it's not to stay safe, it's to stay connected. And they want to stay connected to their friends, to their families, to their community, which, by the way, they're the ones that built the communities we live in. And they want to stay connected also to the outdoors. And those are all the things that we first took away during the lockdowns. You know, they also want to be able to have affordability. So we'll talk about that in a moment with housing. They want to have ease of access of knowing what's out there in terms of services. And they want quality of care when they need it and in the place that they prefer. But number one, if you ask anyone, their answer may be of different words, but it's really rooted in staying connected. It's being seen, it's seeing others, it's contributing, it's having conversation. It's, you know, not going to the giant activity room to play bingo per se. It's about the person they're sitting beside during bingo and the conversation they get to have while they enjoy that activity. I'm being a bit facetious using a very traditional activity example, but when it comes to the built environment, this means we need to look for small places, small settings. That smallness is a virtue when it comes to connection. So smaller dining tables, smaller rooms to sit and talk and have conversation, choices around the areas in which people can visit each other from within the home and outside of the home, access out to the outdoors and being able to enjoy that freedom. There's nothing more than a sense of freedom than being able to walk out your own front door. And so it is really about neighborhood living. It is about the inside coming out and the outside coming in and creating spaces and programs and policies that are intended to increase interactions. And some of that happens accidentally if you design well, and some of it happens with intention. And we've seen moves towards that. We've seen, you know, daycares placed in nursing homes. We've seen, you know, examples of certainly great intergenerational programming. But we miss the fact that we're being almost too prescriptive. It's often when we talk about those interactions or the connections, we're talking about them, about the youngest generation and the oldest generations connecting. And it is not that. Intergenerational is actually multi-generational. It doesn't matter if it's a 40-year-old and a 60-year-old or a 4-year-old and an 80-year-old. There's benefits and values to all of those combinations. So when we look to some of the examples like Humanitas in the Netherlands that people have sometimes heard about, which is, you know, Rhea had a nursing home of residents that she was really trying to develop a turnaround plan for. And she placed post-secondary students into that nursing home, 6 students. And, you know, they were expected to contribute in ways to interact with residents. And that's still existing after 10 plus years. So it's being much more creative in how we cultivate connection, and that we do so not only from a programmatic standpoint, but we do so from a standpoint of the built environment when we have the opportunity to build new or to repurpose. And we also do it from an expectation that the relationships are reciprocal, that the older adults have something to offer, not only something to receive.
And so you've used an example from the Netherlands. Are there any examples in New Brunswick that you could speak to and some lessons learned about what decision makers really need to think about as we take and adapt and adopt to our own geographic and population reality? Far too often we have a cookie cutter template that governments want to overlay. And they, in many cases, they do that through legislation or funding. So I'm really curious as to what you've seen work here and whether that's in New Brunswick or any other part of Canada.
Yeah, so I don't think we've achieved what I'm envisioning yet in Canada, but I'll tell you about a project that we're working on here in New Brunswick that I hope we can really move the needle on. But we've had to do so while sort of ducking between those regulatory environments, if you will. And if we can get policymakers and funders to look at that differently and provide more flexibility for quote-unquote innovation for operators to achieve as they set forth to make developments, that will be really helpful. So when we started this conversation, I said, you know, connection first, housing second. And so when I speak about housing being second, I'm speaking about everyone. You know, everyone, we have a right to a home. We need to recognize the intersection between being sufficiently housed or not vulnerably housed and also care. And we only need to look to ALC or alternative level of care for that. So, you know, I like to say no one's waiting for a bed. Everyone's waiting for a home. And we need to change our nomenclature there because we've, again, medicalized and institutionalized. Even when we're talking about the best of homes that are being developed as care homes, we still are referring to them as beds. and they're not beds. They are someone's home, the residents who live there. And there's lots of operators who have adopted that through culture change and, you know, have evolved their language. Although I would say we're at great risk of person-centeredness having become an item on the checklist and it not really being embedded in all of our operations. So what I believe is that we need to bring housing and care together. And when I talk about housing, I'm talking about multi-unit housing, but that can look like different housing types. That could be co-housing, that can be apartments, that could be row housing. That's really dependent on the environment or the market that where it's being built. It certainly, from my standpoint, should include affordable housing, and that affordable housing should be integrated to housing types. It shouldn't be segregated. You know, the best friend to institutionalization is segregation. And so we really need to recognize that desegregating is a really important objective. We could maybe take a moment and talk about that in terms of persons living with dementia. So in our development here on the East Coast, we are right now constructing a 60-resident nursing home. So what would be considered the higher level of care or skilled nursing or long-term care home in other jurisdictions. And your listeners are listening from all over. And we had to go through a competitive procurement for that and certainly had a vision for including as much community space and decentralizing services and realizing the household model. It'll be the smallest household we have in New Brunswick with residents of 15. But very frankly, as much as I'm proud of that, it's not near good enough. But that development is phase one of three phases. And the second phase will include apartments, including market apartments and affordable housing. We'll integrate additional care. And what I would refer to in a business context is commercial space. It'll really be used for community spaces and civic priorities or clinical space in this particular opportunity. And then the third phase will include some additional housing and care. And so we're just right at the precipice of saying exactly what that will look like. Again, I'm a big proponent of the small household. So I really hope phase two doesn't include just one building, but it includes a grouping of sort of that cottage style, if you will, housing, as well as some multi-level housing and certainly lots of community spaces. But the approach we're taking there is to build out that design and model based on what that community needs. And so I do intend to replicate that in other communities, but it won't be cookie cutter, to your point. People have become accustomed to sort of the campus model, and there are pros and cons to each of these models, but the campus model is still segregated by age. And what I'm talking about is mixed development with diverse citizens. And so in each time we do that, it may look a little different, because it needs to respond to the needs of that community. Maybe that community needs more affordable housing. Maybe that community has a civic priority, like a library, that could be embedded into the development. So what is cookie cutter is applying the same principles to development, community by community. It is not the footprint of the building in which we will build. And that's really where I'm spending the majority of my time to see if we can really realize that. And I'm doing that drawing upon all the models around the world that I've been blessed enough to visit and learn from. But we have to remember that we're playing catch up in regards to some of those models that have been around for, you know, 15 years or so. And so what should we take with those learnings and how do we apply them today? Because when we're building infrastructure and housing, we're building it for 40, 50 years. So yeah, it requires a different thought process and it requires different decision-making criteria, if you will, from a developer's perspective.
Well, to your point about segregation versus integration, we, on one of our earlier episodes in this season, we actually had one of our member homes from our association, People Care, join us together with Trent University and their president, talking about a vision of how to use the university campus as a new space and a new platform for education, for learning, for multi-generational living, for innovations in care to provide that green space, allow for connectivity, to your point. I think one of the challenges that model is still facing Ontario is really how to get others in to join that conversation to enable the possibility of this to be realized. How are you getting the buy-in from your community, however one defines community, And we know that a rural community versus a really urban community or a cultural community or a faith-based community or a linguistic community, we are, to coin Joe Clark, from former Prime Minister of Canada and then community of communities. What do you see as the key ingredients to bring people along?
Big question. It really is about building a new era of neighborhood or stitching our neighborhoods back together. Our neighborhoods have become fragmented. You know, we don't have the same strength in our faith communities as we did traditionally. We don't take muffins to our new neighbors, you know, or bore a cup of sugar like we used to. And there's all sorts of societal reasons for those shifts. But now is the time for us to make that social movement to reestablishing it in a new way. And for me, a lot of that comes down to how are we enabling people to interact with each other and not just one group of residents, but everybody in that neighborhood.
I know when I was working in the children's mental health sector, so this would have been around 2010, there was a big movement through Stanford around collective impact. And at the core of that was a shared common vision. Trust was at the core of it. And it really was about connectivity and finding that common ground and then finding a way to work through to actually achieve that vision, but looking what each individual organization or individual leader could bring to that discussion and making sure that there was alignment, continually challenging to validate, but really establishing the trust that you had each other's back and that you were on the path.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I love that you brought up trust, Donna. Like I often say, that's what we're facilitating is trust. We're just trust building. And when you mentioned collective impact, it takes me back that work of head and heart coming together. Because what I do think sometimes lacks in the argument of those who live in the social impact space is the economic principles associated with making the deal happen, if you will. And what government is often really focused on is the financial case making, if you will. So there's a social thread in that, but there's very much an economic thread. And, you know, we need to look at the care sector to that end. In my mind, I really refer to it as a care economy. And that also sort of levels it up in terms of its potential impact and the understanding that the impact is both social and economic. And I find that resonates, you know, quite well with decision makers on the policy and funding procurement side, because they're very used to that case making. And if we can do it well, then the folks in community development and social impact, I hope, are equally as excited, because we're not building the same thing, or we're not developing or designing the same solutions.
And what you're talking about really is about how we work together. So whether that's the private sector, whether that's provincial government, municipal government, whether that's developers or construction workers or our architects. It really is about bringing the private and the public sector together. And certainly in Ontario, our long-term care homes are actually all publicly funded care. So regardless of who is the owner or operator of your long-term care home, all of the care in the home is actually publicly funded, and everyone at exactly the same level, and no one can actually buy more care from that home. But yet it is anchored in how do we bring the right people together to really conceive of that vision and make it possible. You've mentioned that infrastructure change really comes once every 50 years. We're at that pivot point. As you know, governments, to your point, see things very narrowly, and they see it more as a transaction. Certainly, we talk about the spaces in the homes. We don't use beds, but others do count. But they also just want to get her done. And that cookie cutter, here's the standardized model, here are the standardized plans. This is what we're going to build. I know New Brunswick, I know Ontario, that the landscape of Canada is so highly variable as to where you are. If you're in a remote community, if you're in a rural farming community, whether you're surrounded by trees, whether you're in an urban center, you know, the footprint, what else is around you really matters. So how do you square that imbalance almost, or that tension around thinking and acting today, but planning for a generation that is going to come even 20, 30 years from now, and allow for the innovation that we need to have to be able to adapt to a different resident population, different human resource models, different care models, and for whatever technology may bring.
Yeah, I was thinking about the generation that we're serving now and the generation you referenced 20 to 30 years. And I think you and I are probably in the middle of that in between. And so, yeah, you're right. We need to think about all the generations that are going to be served, particularly when we're building bricks and mortar. I think a few things on that topic. Number one, what hasn't changed as significantly or rapidly is the homes we live in, right? Like, there is some change, but if we actually build homes, I think we will not see as much aversion to the environment, because we all know that we're trying to deinstitutionalize. Nobody raises their hand and says, I hope I live in a nursing home someday. But if we can make that home very different than what we've been building and not about households and about smaller groups of residents. So I think one of the most flexible components to the design is small households. And, you know, our sector sort of accepts household reference of 12 residents or less. I mentioned a home that we're doing at 15 residents, certainly in, you know, we have examples in Canada of 9 and 11, but the 12 really comes from the greenhouse project as a norm, if you will, just because it's the most prolific model of small households and it's one of their trademark requirements. And I think it's good. But if we look at some of the Nordic models in particular, and some that are smaller operations in Canada, we can find resident groupings of 6 or 7. And when you are decentralizing to that level, and that means not just the grouping of residents, but they have access to shared living, kitchen, as well as amenities throughout the development, you can turn that space more easily as changing physical or care needs change, if you will. So perhaps what is needed today is for that for older adults, and perhaps in the future, it'll be needed for a different demographic. So I go back to sort of smallness as a virtue. I think the other things have to do with aesthetic. And so when we talk about making things residential-like, just make them residential because we have had trends in our sector that really, again, came out of the US and we adopted in some operations in Canada that come from hospitality. And some people that might be befitting of, if you want to live in what feels like a hotel for the rest of your life, okay. But lots of people reject that and kind of walk through the doors and say, geez, this is not for me, especially in our Atlantic Canadian or our rural communities, that they want a sense of down home. Because the home, when we talk about residential and we talk about home, it's not just the physical environment. It's home is a feeling. Home is a feeling of familiarity. Home is a feeling of comfort. And so we really need to apply those principles to enabling the design. And the other component of that from a regulatory standpoint is that our policies and our funding models and our procurement even is still very siloed. And it's going to take a while, even though governments are starting to try to abridge that from home care through to end of life care. They're trying. Provinces are pursuing new legislation. Some provinces are making commitments to supporting family and friend caregivers in a different way. There's lots of things happening there, but it's slow moving. It's very slow moving change. What the provinces or the provincial government who need to do is enable the operators or the providers to respond to the needs. Government's job is not to solve the problem. Government's job is to enable the solutions. And so I used to say for years, I'm rethinking this of late, but I'll still share it. Let's just take a classic RFP that's based on a per diem for a nursing home or long-term care development. And, you know, you're going through the procurement document and it has all sorts of visions and philosophies about deinstitutionalization and small homes and all the good stuff. But yet it scores, and it maybe even scores you on that, but then best price or blended price wins and provinces don't want to pay as much. And that's why we still see new bills that are very institutional. There's just a lack of flexibility that needs to be offered out to the market, if you will. So just give us the price and we'll build what we can to that. We'll let the people who operate and, to be honest, live and work in these homes, let them figure it out. The provincial governments don't need to figure that out. They just need to figure out what they can afford, how high the demand is, make sure you have open data so the market can make good decisions. But I think there's a switch there that we can flip while the big change is still being worked on moving the big rocks of systemic change on the policy and the regulation and the legislation. We can be building differently today and enabling that even within the constraints of the existing procurement and policies and whatnot. So that just takes people being creative, nimble, a little bolder, a little wiser, but more flexible. And I think you'll find there are operators willing, ready. It's so hard to duck and weave amongst those silos today. So, and that all comes down to asking ourselves over and over again, what does the citizen want? And really applying that values-based decision-making to the funding, to the design, to the regulation, to all of it. And, you know, questioning everything as we go so that we can learn and then iterate in terms of those new models and those changes that are contextualized to Canada and Canada's communities. Development is a creative process. It's also an economic process, right? So if you just need to let the people who know how to do it well and the ones that are willing to sort of push that vision forward, the government needs to enable that and give that more space. That's what innovation is. I sort of say it's catch up in many regards, but it is innovation in a Canadian context because we haven't seen, you know, a development based on connection, housing, and care come to full fruition here. We've got lots of people moving things forward, but I think we can take a much bigger step forward, and I think we can do it today.
You're so familiar with different approaches and models that are unfolding. Really curious about your thoughts of nursing homes without walls. So this is some work that New Brunswick has really been leading Canada on together with Health Excellence Canada. It is an initiative that we're looking at in Ontario, Canada, to see how could we adapt that to our regulatory and funding and staffing and geography, what is, you know, the Ontario reality. But welcome your thoughts in terms of the opportunity that sort of approach could present.
Yeah, I think Nursing Home Without Walls, the innovator behind that is Dr. Suzanne Dupuis-Blanchard, and she's a great friend and colleague. And that project came out, or that model came out of an initial pilot project in New Brunswick that was funded through the Healthy Seniors Pilot Project with the support from Health Canada and from our province, and now has expanded. So the results were very positive. Our province has made us a commitment to expand it. It is scaling. It is now scaling even more. So we've had successive governments, including our newest Liberal government who's been elected under Premier Susan Hault, has committed to further expansion, all very positive. But the bottom line in that model is that it is rooted in recognizing that the nursing home, in this case, is a community asset. And so anybody that comes from the community development world will understand sort of the asset mapping, if you will, or ABCD development. If you're familiar with Tamarack, is one of the best places to go to and find that information. And it's really about assets-based community development. That's the ABCD. And so really what is part of that process is mapping needs and resources and trying to find the alignment that we talked about before at a stakeholder level that I was mentioning. It's really finding that at a very grassroots level, enabling the community to do that. And thus the Nursing Home Without Walls, I think one of the things that is really impactful about it is that it in of itself is not a cookie cutter program, if you will. It is really a model of how to address needs in community. And even in New Brunswick, now that we have, I'd have to look at the number, but maybe 20 or more homes that are involved and more joining all the time, the resulting offering out of Nursing Home Without Walls doesn't look the same in every community, because certain nursing homes have different resources to provide. Some have physical space, some have additional staff or volunteer capacity, and each of those communities needs different things. So some of the programming has been focused on community transportation, some is on Meals on Wheels, some is on day programs. And so they're all good things. It really is just a model that it is enabling that asset mapping and the resource allocation. And the government is pitching it a bit of money for the coordination of that on an ongoing basis, which is positive, because the last thing we need to do is enable community without any dollars and cents, which happens all the time. And that's a whole other topic, especially from a healthcare perspective. But the Nursing Home Without Walls, or the Without Walls model, Hospital Without Walls, you know, here we have our assisted living structure is referred to largely as special care homes. Now there are operators that are interested in using their special care homes in that same community asset basis, and their staff and their families and their residents want to contribute to that same model. So yeah, it's a fantastic model in terms of grassroots connecting people with resources they need and want, and those that are available in the community. And yeah, it's fantastic to be able to say that it's come out of New Brunswick, and Suzanne and team members have done a great job. But it's really rooted in community development.
No, thanks for that. I'm really impressed with the work that New Brunswick is leading on this. And Suzanne should be, I think, really commended for her leadership, but also the work with Health Excellence Canada and thinking about how do we spread and scale this and build on the model and adapt that model. One thing I did want to ask you about, because I really love the way that you synthesize your values and your framework and your priorities. So you've got connected housing care. But I know you also have another question matrix that you use. Could you talk about how you use that as you lead the work that you are so clearly leading in reimagining how seniors care, living in a care, can be better integrated and connected into community?
I mean, I have some questions that I pull out often. So the first one is just, would we do this in our own home? And so anytime we're building or working on the design of a built environment, and I'm looking to challenge, or people are just trying to make a decision, it could be as simple as paint colors. Look, we just went through a development, and when we were going through the choices on aesthetic and interior design, the design team had, it was like a teal, like a turquoisey teal green that was going to be on the resident doors, right? And I had a bit of an aversion to that, because we talk about residents being able to personalize their space. And so what should we really give them? Should we give them a bright teal bedroom, or should we give them something more neutralized? In fairness, the design team had neutral colors in the mix as well. But my point and the question to be asked and helping people decide is, you know, is that the color you would paint your door in your own home? And if the answer is no, then don't present it in this development either, right? If we're going to do residential, like, we just do residential, we just ask ourselves. And the same token would be, you know, I use this comment often, or this question often, when talking about access to the outdoors, because often development sites get clear-cutted. You know, schools are one of the best examples of that, but care homes, we do that as well. There's a lot of emphasis on green space, but it's the first thing to get cut from the development. The number one priority in traditional development is density and the biggest footprint on the site test fit. And I'm pushing against all of those things so that green space is prioritized and actually utilized. So when we are in our own home, how do we enjoy the outdoors? Do we walk out the front door? Do we walk out the back door? Do we have a garage? Do we have a deck? Like, different environments have different things in Canada with all of our different climates. But, you know, we're able to just walk out. And so making sure that access point is easily accessible within design is really important. You know, talking about what that landscaping looks like is really important. So yeah, it's probably a question I ask every week, to be honest, when I'm on a site or in a design related meeting, when people are saying, oh, we've decided to do this, or we're thinking about that, and they're looking for an answer. you know, I like to answer a question with a question. And that question is often, would you do that in your own home? And it makes the decision-making quite easy, to be honest. Another question that I often use as a filter, oh, does it bring more connections? Thank you. So yeah, so asking that, like even conversations about like one of my least favorite topics, but it's like access control, right? Like, so how do people unlock and lock the doors? Which doors need to be secure? Which ones do not? And, you know, so you'll see folks who are trying to achieve that decentralized or household model, and they'll put laundry rooms in the households, right, where the residents reside. And often there's a duplicated sort of commercial laundry in the main building or something as well. But then the laundry rooms are locked and nobody can get into them. Well, then what's the point of putting them there, right? And, you know, so again, I'm being a bit facetious, but it's asking about those that connectivity to the outdoors, connectivity to each other. And I think I'm excited about applying that question more and more in terms of integrated design and not co-location. It's not to say there won't be any co-location, but how can that be done with full connectivity? You know, take Sue Ellen Beatty and team out at Sherbrooke Community Center in Saskatoon. And they're the ones with the iGen classroom, which is a grade 6 class that's been around for 10 years now. And I just had the good fortune of being out there a month or so ago. And the iGen class, grade 6 students within that district need to apply and they're chosen for that program. And they spend their whole grade 6 academic year in that community, in that home. And they don't really even have a classroom. They sort of have carts and they move around the space. And on the flip side, I had a conversation with somebody about that in Atlantic Canada, that model. And it was like, well, I'm not sure we have a classroom. I'm not sure we could dedicate a class. We don't need a classroom, right? Does the classroom breed more connectivity or less? And the answer is less. So what can we do to make that classroom more mobile and bring those students to all parts of the home, which increases connection? And it's, again, that accidental and purposeful interaction. And you just can't, you can't fake that stuff. You can't replace that. It's a feeling you when you walk into a home and you get to see it with your own eyes. When I was at Sherbrooke or even at Hogeveen in the Netherlands, you can't really tell who's a resident, who's staff, who's family, who's a volunteer. And a lot of that has to do with how people are interacting in the space, has to do with plain clothes and not having scrubs. It's because you're in a more normalized setting. And so those are the learnings we need to harvest, but then we need to take them even further because those models were founded 15 years ago. We should be asking about how is that enabling connection and not forgetting that the residents in our care homes, regardless of their level of care, an opportunity for them to continue to contribute, that they have something to give and not only to receive. We almost need to force ourselves to just pause sometimes, slow down a little bit, put the checklist away and just have a conversation.
Well, and to that point around keeping it local, having these local discussions, thinking about who's in your community, focusing on living long-term care homes or care homes as homes, not facilities, not institutions, really stepping back to bring people in. In Ontario, in September, through our association, we had members across the province who had a long-term care community engagement day. It was our individual homes, their frontline staff, their families, their volunteers, their residents, inviting their local officials in, whether that was mayors or counselors, community partners from a local hospital or some community service providers, to bring them in to meet the residents, to meet the staff, to see the home, to experience it, and to, again, that humanize it. This isn't just a building and a box with beds. This is where people live. This is where people work, where they support one another and care together. And the feedback that we've had from our members and the experiences of that day was really magical. And we're going to do it again next September. But trying to find those ways, because of the stigma of the pandemic and this fear of aging, I think there's ageism at play in this as well. I think there's such an opportunity to build on your vision. And what I would say as well is we've both been to the Netherlands. We know a lot of our colleagues who've been to Denmark and have looked at different models across the United States and in Australia and New Zealand. And yet we don't look to ourselves to acknowledge that here in Canada, there is a lot of innovation happening. a lot of that sharing by going to see those other programs and stepping back to think about the art of the possible. How do we make this fit our communities? So I really want to thank you for your leadership and for sharing with us, because I think we need to celebrate more. I talk about how Ontario has invested billions in funding for education, for innovation, for new care supports, for 4 hours of care, supporting emotion-focused care models to unfold in the province, to foster some greater collaboration, and to actually rebuild our old buildings. I think they've probably done more in terms of those investments than any other jurisdiction in the world right now. They don't get credit for it, but it was catching us up. We still have a lot of work to do. And I think by including the people who may well need these services in the future in today's discussion and bringing them in and helping them realize the art of the possible is one that gives me great hope and optimism.
Yeah, I certainly share that hope. I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful for my home province in New Brunswick. We have, as I mentioned before, a new government in place that has made commitments and is starting to roll out those commitments very promptly after being elected to office. People are more understanding, decision makers are more understanding of the social context, that social care and healthcare, we just need to recalibrate, right? And it's not to say there aren't citizens with complex needs, and we need to accommodate that as well. But talking en masse, we need to balance the social care and healthcare, not have one sacrificed for the other. So even when you're talking about your stakeholder engagement or your operators coming together, you know, just by virtue of you folks enabling that out in the sector, as opposed to a government facilitated engagement, is really important. And, you know, the art of the possible is, yes, it means we should think creatively, but for whom? And it's for those with lived experience. And so none of this work can be done well unless you place emphasis and value on lived experience. We're all experts in our own lives. And so if we just ensure that we're asking those folks with lived experience to help inform the quote unquote innovation or solutioning, then I think we can get there much more quickly. What happens now is inconsistent. There are gaps in between. We're starting to build the same apathy and that kind of engagement that sector providers have felt for years because there's no accountability. And that's the other piece that is missing from this whole formula, is that if we want to make decisions based on quality of life, then we need to measure quality of life. And that's the accountability we need to be held to. And we can measure it. Even, again, your global audience, you know, most would be familiar with Interi as a measurement tool. There are others, but let's just take that one. And I use that one a lot because in New Brunswick, we already use some of the modules. In Ontario, you use them. And there are quality of life measures. And so let's report on that in terms of a inspection process and not just all of the other things that are there from a safety lens. It really needs to be recalibrated. I'm very hopeful. I think it's very possible. What I love about New Brunswick too is, you know, I've said a few times today that smallness is a virtue, and I mean that in terms of design and spaces and all of those kinds of things, but we're also a small province. And so we're very fortunate to be all connected one way or another. And it sounds like you're getting the right people in the right room in Ontario, which is great. We're certainly nimble in New Brunswick if we're really all aligned to the same goal. And the goal that I'm rallying for right now is to eliminate ALC, right? Because when we really talk about these things of connection and housing and care, none of us need to look further than alternative level care and citizens that are awaiting in hospital. I had a post on LinkedIn and someone's comment was ALC equals homelessness. And I thought, yeah, that's true. They don't have a home at that moment in time when they're living in hospital. So yeah, I think if we, you know, just ask people, you know, what, and maybe it sounds oversimplified, but I truly think that's where you find the magic, is you just ask, what do you need? And not just let the system assume that you need a level 3 nursing home. Are there other alternatives? Are there other resources in your community, in your family? And many of those policies and programs already exist, but they're not being well leveraged. We just need to roll up our sleeves and commit to getting it done and then hold ourselves accountable to that and be much more transparent in that accountability. I share your hope across Canada, but I certainly call New Brunswick home and I'm hopeful we can set some precedents here.
Well, I look forward to following your progress and the progress of your peers, to supporting your work, helping to spread and scale, and to making sure that everybody's using those three words, connecting, housing, and care, with connecting coming first. So, Emmy Forman, thank you so much for your time, for your leadership, for your hope, for being the little province that could and is doing.
Thanks, Don. I appreciate having this conversation today.
Thank you for listening to Coming of Age, the podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care and aging. We hope this episode brings a new perspective and inspires you to continue the conversation with your colleagues, friends, and family. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so that more listeners will join our community of changemakers in seniors' care. Until next time, I'm your host, Donna Duncan. Keep well. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Staffstat. Staffstat is a software platform dedicated to transforming workforce management in healthcare. Designed to streamline operations for long-term care homes, retirement homes, hospitals, and other healthcare organizations, the platform eliminates administrative burdens and enables dynamic shift predictions and efficient shift fulfillment. Staffstat reduces manual tasks, optimizes internal staffing processes, and enhances communication between leadership and frontline teams. Book a discovery call today at www.staffstat.ca.